Welcome to the Lift Every Voice podcast, where we explore books by contemplative writers of color. I'm Christine Walters Paintner.
And I'm Claudia Love Meyer. We are joined each month by the author of our book club selection. Together, we explore how increasing our diversity of perspectives on contemplative practice can enrich our experience of the Christian mystical tradition.
We encourage you to join us by reading the book, listening to the conversations, and engaging with the reflection questions on our website at abbeyofthearts.com.
Welcome, everyone, to our Lift Every Voice book club podcast. And I'm here with Claudia Love Meyer, my ongoing conversation partner. And this month, we are delighted to welcome Mihi Kim Court, who wrote this beautiful book, Outside the Lines, How Embracing Queerness Will Transform Your Faith. And Mihi was born in Seoul, Korea, and she and her parents immigrated to Colorado in the U.S. shortly after her birth. She's an ordained Presbyterian minister and is co-pastor with her spouse of First Presbyterian Church in Annapolis, Maryland, and a doctoral candidate in religious studies at Indiana University. She's also the author of Making Paper Cranes Toward Asian American Feminist Theology and a co-author with her husband, Andy, of Yoked Stories of a Clergy Couple in Marriage, Family, and Ministry, as well as contributors to numerous other volumes. And we are delighted to be talking today about Outside the Lines. So welcome, Mihi. It's great to have you here.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Maybe we could just start by asking you sort of what led you to write this book in particular. You know, what was the inspiration and the impetus? And
You know, it was a season in my life where it felt like a number of different things were sort of converging. In some ways, I'd just become a mother. I had given birth to twins in 2011, and then an unexpected third in 2013. And we had at the same time moved to a completely different part of the country, and I had to sort of put on pause my vocational commitments. You know, I stepped down from ministry full time and focused on being the primary caregiver. And I started to really think about and have more space to think about and reflect on my own being and what that meant in these sort of different in that season of life where everything sort of shifted and really shifted away from what I had anticipated or expected, you know, when I was in seminary, when I was in college, when I was growing up. And so I was in a space where I was able to, I was curious and had access to some wonderful resources. So we were in Bloomington, Indiana, and I started to audit some gender studies courses. And this is sort of a little known fact. IU is the first school to offer a PhD in gender studies. So they very much are, they're very much on the forefront of a lot of these sort of conversations. The Kinsey Institute is also located on campus. So lots of resources there around sexuality and identity as well. So I really started to have conversations with myself, with folks, with different theorists and literatures. And it really opened up a whole world for me. And I think that at that time, I really thought that I would do more of what in my mind I was calling sort of an academic book. Like I really wanted to just look at, do more of like a lit review, you know, in some ways, see what was out there and then do some engagement and more critical reflection based on what I was reading and learning. And at the time when I was working on this with Fortress Press, which we had a line of books that they wanted to start a series in some ways, they were looking towards more accessible kind of writing and reading and all that. And so I was sort of, you know, intent on doing something academic. And then they were like, we're not really looking for that. And the writing eventually became, you know, it became very personal. It became a way to look at my own history and my own stories, and then sort of to really deal honestly with what this was opening up for me. And so I always sort of tell this story about encountering during this time a filmmaker, a Korean American filmmaker named Andrew Ahn. He came to IU and did this beautiful talk, showed a couple of films, short films, and he explained that these films were a way of coming out to his family and to his parents in particular. And I loved that sort of possibility, seeing that being so clearly embodied in his life and in his work. And so I took this writing as a way to come out in a certain way. Coming out is sort of a weird phrase, though. You know, it's less of a coming out and more of this sort of dawning realization, sort of emerging and kind of understanding more fully every day, every season, who I am in God and in terms of desire, sexuality, identity, relationships. And so that's sort of what was the main impetus for writing.
I really like what you're saying about, you know, coming out, quote unquote, is not like a one-time event. It's more of a unfolding process, like all of our self-awareness is. And yeah, I think that's a lovely nuanced way to describe it. Yeah.
Thanks.
Should I go? It's my turn.
Sure, Claudia, love.
Mihi, I felt so much compassion for you when I read your opening story about the photographer who mistook you for a man and the shame that you felt because of that experience. Could you tell us about the conflict you felt within when you were viewed as queer before you even came to terms with that yourself?
Yeah, I grew up in a pretty traditional and conservative home at numerous levels, you know, an immigrant family, a Korean immigrant family, a Korean Protestant, you know, Christian family. So there were all these sort of layers of so many parts of my life that really fed me the same script. What I often say is the same script over and over in terms of what it means to be fulfill certain roles, i.e. in terms of gender. And so that seemed to be, I would say, the most pressing script that we were compelled to internalize, what it means to be a woman, to look like a woman, you know, at the time a girl, you know, so of course there's, you know, that shift from girl to woman and all that. Yeah, for the longest time, I'd always struggled with, like I knew there was always, and sometimes I leaned into my difference. I think that in some ways I was okay with and liked being different. But at the same time, you know, I think that might've been just a way for me. It was like a, what do you call it? You know, some sort of strategy for just dealing with the feelings of inadequacy and sometimes loneliness and just feeling like no one really, like I barely understood what was happening, but I just knew that something was, for lack of a better phrase at this point, off. And so, so even, you know, even if I struggled with that tension in that season and that time, you know, in that moment, to have that come be placed on me externally in such a clear, and then this was from someone, and at the time I didn't register this, but someone who was white as well. It felt like there were a lot of sort of racially inflected, you know, stuff around gender and sexuality was very much inflected. Like I was just not, I was failing in some ways at being a human and then being seen and understood and read as a human. So yeah, it has obviously stayed with me for a long time.
Thank you. Yeah. Sorry that happened.
Yeah. No, it's okay. I mean, I think now when I look back on it, you know, if I had been given different language and resources and tools to sort of understand the culture that I was growing up in and how it sort of diminished that aspect of me. And if I hadn't just, you know, accepted that because I wasn't following the script of looking like and sounding like and being read as a woman at the time, I think that I maybe would have received that in a different way. I think today, I mean, I pretty much read as, you know, a very cisgendered woman, you know, but every once in a while, I mean, I think every once in a while, I imagine if like now the mindset that I have now and the perspective that I have now, if I had had that at that point, I think that it wouldn't have bothered me as much. But because I was so focused on dealing with what it meant to be and exhibit a certain gender identity, that definitely, you know, was super hurtful.
Yeah.
I understand. There's a lot more generosity around queerness now that, you know, even 10 years ago. Well, it's among people that are queer and queer affirming. The government is in the U.S. is not about that life, but
yeah.
But in terms of just acceptance day to day, I'm really glad that's opened up some.
Well, and the subtitle of your book is How Embracing Queerness Will Transform Your Faith, and you talk about how Jesus acted queerly. You say that we could describe his actions as the dictionary definition of queer, strange or odd from a conventional viewpoint, unusually different. So I'd love to hear more about the queer Jesus and how embracing this queerness will, you know, ultimately help to transform our faith.
Yeah. I think that, you know, I think that we grow up with these stories of Jesus, you know, and his ministry, his teaching, his acts of healing. And, you know, at least in the church that I grew up in, and the Christianity that I grew up in, it feels like those stories were very sort of domesticated and diluted. You know, they were kind of sort of, in some ways, made to be palatable to a very heteronormative culture. And so, you know, we didn't really think about Jesus, you know, as maybe a male identifying person. We didn't really think too much about Jesus and his sexuality. It was kind of either, you know, sidelined or sort of a given. So we didn't really need to talk about it, the sort of unspoken given. But I think that the more I considered the possibility of, and, you know, it's a hermeneutic approach for sure in terms of reading Jesus as queer, I think that just really opened up how beautiful and radical and revolutionary his relationships were and his interaction was, and the way that he touched people and moved people and inspired. And even just thinking about the kinds of miraculous acts and the way that he embodied and enacted those miracles, I think in itself, in themselves are to read them as queer, I think opens up the possibility of a different kind of humanity being embodied in Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so for me, like reading him as queer, just really actually, like I talk about it in terms of, you know, deepening my faith, deepening my relationship with Jesus, and just a deeper love, you know, a deeper sort of, I don't know if it's empathy or connection, but this sense of, now it feels like there's more flesh and blood on him. And he's not just this kind of character, you know, we've done that with so many of our heroes, you know, everybody from, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. to, you know, I think of my own personal heroes, like, in the US or in Korea or globally, you know, we've just kind of turned them into two-dimensional characters that kind of just fit the narrative we need in the moment. But they were you know, fully embodied and complex beings. And there's so much more there that's exciting. And I think more generative in terms of shaping my own life.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And because I love this image of, well, you know, obviously Jesus was so countercultural. And when you talk about, you know, this two-dimensional Jesus, of course, we have, you know, this whole religious right perspective on Jesus, where he is very flattened and to fit into that kind of heteronormative role. And, you know, and yet it's clear from the Gospels that he does push the boundaries. He does step outside the lines. He does, you know, push all of the buttons of the religious hierarchy. And so, yeah. And I also love to think of how that term queer Jesus would really rile up some of the right-wing people, just in terms of, you know, like, it's such a powerful image to claim, you know, that I love and follow somebody who is willing to push the boundaries. So anyway, thank you for that.
Yeah. I mean, like, he hung out with men all the time, or like prostitutes, you know, like his sexuality is super slippery and questionable. And, you know, these homosocial behaviors for sure, you know, and that's, you know, that's replicated all over the world. I think that's, yeah. I mean, why don't we lean into that a little bit more? I mean, I think that would say so much to us and show us so much about love and intimacy and relationship, and the need for those kinds of, that sort of expression of belonging, that example of belonging. It's not just, I guess today I would think of like the nuclear family always feels like it's just lifted up as, mm-hmm. you know, the picture of, you know, knowing who you are and where you're from kind of thing.
Yeah. Thank you for that.
So I, you know, grew up in a Black church, and it was, you know, very conservative. And it was like, and even when I left the Black church and kind of explored other charismatic kind of churches, the hard line was, you know, abortion and queerness, though I don't think they would have used the word queer at that time. Yeah. And so I went to the Institute of Black Catholic Studies in my late 40s. And we were reading a book by, I think it was by Sean Copeland. Mm-hmm. And she said, Jesus is queer. Mm-hmm. And it was at that moment that I began to shift my perspective, you know, because, you know, that whole love the sinner, hate the sin. Yeah, that's where I came from. And then I knew, okay, wait a minute. It's not just, you know, love the sinner, hate the sin. It's just truly opening up, you know, to being queer as normal. And now, like I said, I've come to a greater acceptance, because I'm not going to lie, I believed what I was taught, you know, and it took loving people who are queer and not the sin, just loving. Mm-hmm. So my question is, you encourage us to embrace queerness. So who is queer? What does that mean when you, you know, ask us to, hey, embrace this, that it'll change you?
Yeah, no, that's great. I think that's something I think about, you know, even though I don't do as much with this book as I did at the very beginning, you know, obviously during the writing, but then even after it was published and, you know, having those the different conversations with different groups of people to really sort of try to parse out, or at least I would say like put some meat on, you know, some flesh on this, you know, so queerness for me, is less of an identity, like a specific identity that you can sort of check off on, like, you know, those governmental forms, you know, but in a lot of ways, a space and an invitation to a certain way of moving through the world. So, So I mentioned in the introduction, you know, at the beginning, and I think I still hold to that in terms of the three sort of ways I understand queerness, in terms of it being a practice, it being about playfulness. I can't even remember the first one. Oh, wait, I have the book right here. I forgot that I'd grabbed it. you know, it was sort of a jumping off point for me to think of posture. That's what it is as well. You know, we can sort of move and orient ourselves in a lot of different ways. And so to me, queerness is a specific way of holding yourself and moving through the world as yourself. And so your question though is super compelling to me in terms of who is queer in the world and how do we embrace them? Because, you know, queerness is not just to me this sort of nebulous force in the world. You know, it's located in bodies, you know, it's located in relationships. And so, you know, and I ran into some, I think, helpful, good conversations. I mean, there were people who pushed back for sure in terms of folks, for instance, who identified as queer and felt like to call anything a queer theology was actually sort of antithetical in their opinion to the project of queerness, because queerness is supposed to be unassimilable. It's supposed to be outside of category, you know, outside of the bounds, outside of the lines. But I still felt like it still needed to be located in the material world, you know, in terms of people and relationships and communities. And so, you know, I definitely locate queerness, you know, in the LGBTQ plus community, you know, folks who identify themselves specifically in terms of sexuality, in terms of gender identity. But I love the possibility that queerness can manifest itself in weird and wonderful and surprising and complex ways. So, you know, I know people get super frustrated. I even heard very recently somebody refer to, because someone else was sort of stumbling over the acronym of LGBT, you know, like trying to, and so someone else like laughed and said, oh, you know, alphabet soup. And that annoyed me for a second because it felt very dismissive. But then I do love that there continues to be this sort of expansion, you know, in terms of folks who identify as asexual, or folks who identify as aromantic, folks who identify as genderqueer or non-binary. And to me, that means that queerness is constantly expanding and constantly inclusive, like bringing people in. So I would love for more people to identify as queer. This was pushback again from other folks this time. And this is, you know, I always say this, I say, you know, take it for what it's worth. I may be suggesting things in my voice still, but I usually would get pushback from white female allies who would say, oh, you know, if everybody's queer, doesn't that one diminish people who identify as LGBTQ plus? Does it diminish the violence and the oppression and the marginalization, especially from the church? And I said, you know, I often would respond, you know, my work, I try to acknowledge that as much as possible. I try to acknowledge some of the privilege that I hold as someone who reads as cisgendered, someone who's in a very heteronormative marriage on the surface, because I'm married to a cisgendered man. But I also like to push back and say, you know, queerness will not be contained. It's going to just sort of blow up and show up in places that you least expect. And there are now, I think, a lot more conversations. I mean, there has been, but I think that it's becoming a lot more mainstream, is this sense of seeing how these identities, we can't talk about these identities apart from other identities to see the ways they intersect. So race and ability and gender, all of these are, or generation is what I meant to say, age. I think these are all, and sort of nationality, you know, economics, these are all these are all supposed to be a part of these conversations around queerness. They're not just singular sort of siloed identities, because if we do that, then we're just replicating structures of oppression once more. And we're expecting people to be a certain way. And if they don't read, if they don't check off all the boxes, then they don't belong. You know, which is what I've been struggling against like my entire life. And so, you know, belonging is very important to me. And I guess I think ultimately queerness, you know, what it means to embrace those who are queer, I think it's teaching me to embrace as much as I can everyone. And I know that sounds very diluted, but that's the way, I mean, I feel like that's the message of Jesus too, that all the people that I hate and I find aggravating, that God still loves them. That's so weird to me. It's so queer. I don't understand it. But to sort of try to participate in that is so transformative and so life-changing.
I know what you mean by, you know, just kind of embracing love and love for everybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, I find it very difficult to love Tucker Carlson, but yeah. God loves Tucker Carlson.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate this expansion of what it means to be queer. Growing up, you know, you were gay, you were a lesbian, even being bisexual, you know, wasn't something that was talked about in the early 80s in the small isolated Black community that I lived in. And now, you know, I have friends that are trans. I have friends that are non-binary. And so I've come to understand people were always like this, but now they're visible. You know, their voices are being heard. And I really, really appreciate that. One of my non-binary friends, they wear a pin that says, you know, they, them. And I'm glad that people are using the pronouns that affirm how they identify. And so I asked them yesterday, because they were wearing a pin, I said, I think I want to get a pin with my pronouns, she, her. And I said, do you think that would be disrespectful? And she said, we really need cis people, to straight cis people, to wear their pronouns, because it normalizes it. Mm-hmm. So again, I'm really grateful for this expansion in like the consciousness of people, whether they are for or against.
Yeah. Thanks for that story.
Yeah. And I want to kind of dig a little deeper into queerness and your connection with weirdness, because you have this great quote where you say queerness embraces and cultivates that weirdness. It sees deviation as normal and normative. It sees what is perplexing, rare, or unfamiliar as a possibility for a new glorious iteration, not only of humanity, but of all creation, which is such a fabulous, you know, way of saying, you know, this is the queer God, is the God who, you know, breaks through our, you know, very confined, constrained perspectives on the world. Yeah. And so I love that idea of weirdness as a principle, and in part because in our own community, Abbey of the Arts, we call ourselves a holy disorder of dancing monks, in part because I also want to push back against this idea of like orderly and what, you know, what does it mean to follow, you know, a particular order. And so, and this image of artists as edge dwellers, because I think obviously that identity as artist often brings along with it a queerness in terms of that sense of wanting to push the boundaries of things. I think if people are doing their art well and call the dominant culture into question. So I wonder if you could just speak a little bit more to the weirdness and that expansiveness that it speaks to.
I think, I mean, just, I have such an interesting relationship with the word normal, you know, because a lot of normal was sort of couched in, again, around expectations for gender. And growing up, you know, because I grew up in an immigrant family, you know, and I think that now that I think about it, you know, I'm starting to learn more and more that a lot of times what people are saying or expecting you to do, or, you know, telling or instructing you to do or criticizing, for example, is often their shit. But, you know, for again, to just put very simply, it's the stuff that they're dealing with in their own life. So I'm trying to be gracious, still trying to see, you know, have that be an opportunity for extending grace. And so I'm trying to extend grace always to my parents, who I love so much, of course, you know, I know that goes without saying in this case, or should go without saying. And growing up, that was the mantra from them that I heard all the time. Just be normal. Why can't you just be normal? Because I was nuts. I was bonkers. I was all over the place. You know, and they love to just say you're a tomboy. And that was just sort of their way of dealing with it, you know, dealing with how I didn't fit their expectations of what it meant to be a Korean Christian girl, which was quiet and submissive and calm, you know, and at home, you know, in the domestic space all the time, doing what I was supposed to do, learning how to cook and clean and all that, which I still did. I was always, yeah, I was doing the exact opposite. And so I think a lot of my life growing up was trying to tamp down that weirdness until I realized that weirdness was a symptom of, I think, something deeper, and something important and necessary in my life, which was queerness, I guess, would be one way of putting it. And so, yeah, you know, there's so much in our culture, right? You know, we put so many bounds and structures to try to squeeze people in. And again, I'm just going to go back to the whole, like, my parents saying it often. I think that they just felt weird, you know, as immigrants, not knowing the language, trying to make a way, you know, through these two cultures, feeling consistently displaced and out of sorts and all that. And me, I'm just, you know, out there. And they were, I think if they were going to try to control anything, you know, of course it made sense to try to control their eldest, their daughter, who was way too, you know, okay with being weird. And now I think that, you know, it could be a spiritual practice, you know, embracing and encouraging weirdness, in a lot of ways. You know, it helps us to see in a different way. I think it makes us more empathetic to people. And I think art definitely is one of those, it's one of those, I wouldn't say tools, that sounds, you know, so, I don't know. It sounds so sort of rigid in some ways, but I feel like art and poetry and all that's, you know, sort of outside what's, you know, like the Enlightenment and rationality and modernity and all that, anything that's sort of outside of that, I think those are our guides. You know, they teach us, it teaches us to see and embrace weirdness as something that we need. You know, I think it's necessary for our survival. I just think about all the ways my soul shrivels up, you know, when that weirdness is, you know, choked out of people's lives. Because that's the stuff that's, I don't know, exciting and life-giving.
Yeah, and that's what I find when people come, you know, to our community, is that they're, you know, they have this longing, but they have felt weird in whatever, you know, more traditional community they've been a part of. Mm-hmm. And finally, there's just a breaking point where, you know, they're just not willing to do that anymore, or they're just so relieved to find some kindred spirits. Anyway, I love that. And I just find it so, like, similar to what we're talking about in terms of Jesus, you know, acting so queerly in his life and breaking all those boundaries. And then I think of, like, the story of Pentecost and how, you know, the Spirit comes in to, like, blow open the doors. Totally. And yet somehow that's been translated, you know, into this very sort of conservative mentality in a lot of churches where, you know, you have to act a certain way. And I just find it so ironic, you know, but anyway, I'm glad you're lifting up these qualities because they're so needed.
Yeah, I like that tie into Pentecost and the Holy Spirit. And that's, I mean, we have a lot we can learn from our Pentecostal and charismatic siblings, you know, in the capital C church. And I sometimes like to call myself a Presbycostal. I think that, there's something that gets lost sort of in our theology and our, you know, when we try to think about who Jesus is, I guess maybe it is very Presbyterian to think about, you know, we're very Trinitarian too, of course, but I don't know who God is or who Jesus is without the Holy Spirit. And I don't, there's no way for me to totally understand who a person is or what a person is trying to say, without the Holy Spirit being present. And even like art and of course, you know, any kind of poetry or any sort of writing, I always feel like is, you know, without the Holy Spirit, I mean, communication is just so hard. And I feel like the Holy Spirit, you know, makes understanding connection possible, you know, without whom, you know, we just, I think we would still just be really off. Not in a good way, you know, we'd be disconnected from one another. Yeah.
Thank you. That's a beautiful connection. I love that.
Two incidents I want to tell you about. And I go to a Catholic, a Black Catholic church that has a certain flavor that's basically Black church with the Eucharist. But anyway, the more that I grow as a person, and I'm 58 right now, so the older I get, the more I've changed. And if I look at the person that I was when I first became a Christian at 15, and the person I am now, she would not think I am a Christian. I think a lot of my Facebook friends no longer think that I'm a Christian. And so I was at Mass one day, and I have, this is a very interesting Catholic church because my priest is young and like he'll be doing a sermon and just stop and start rapping. It's the first time I've been, you know, I had a pre-settled, you know, Busta Rhymes, but it's still Catholic church. And so one day he was talking about the man with the demons that Jesus healed. And so I'm arguing in my head because they're talking about demons. And I'm like, no, he's probably just like epileptic or something like that. Yeah. And then they were on another occasion, they were talking about the woman with an issue of blood. And once again, yeah, she's probably really sick. You know, she shouldn't have been isolated. She should have been helped.
Yeah.
And you write about the woman with the issue of blood. And I would like for you to share what you think her story is and why you chose to include that in the book.
Goodness. Oh, man, it's been a while since I have thought about that story and even the way that I engage and talk about that story. You know, the way that I sort of, and I, you know, this is after the fact, you know, Will Gaffney's book, The Womanist Midrash, she does a lot around, she talks a lot about a particular kind of imagination, a sanctified imagination in terms of the way that she engages the various women in the Old Testament. And I think that that's what I was trying to do at the time when I was writing this, you know, and inspired by other biblical scholars as well in terms of their interaction with texts and other, you know, pastors and writers, et cetera. There's sort of this fabulative, sort of method and approach to these texts, you know, not just simply taking the scripture at face value, but this time, I guess, reading between the lines as opposed to just outside the lines. And at the time, you know, I was imagining what it would be like to be completely isolated from your community. And at the time I was a mother. I mean, I'm still a mother, a young mother, not young anymore, a young mother to young children. And, I guess if she had some sort of a blood disease, I wonder, you know, it probably maybe would be difficult to have children, maybe difficult to have a relationship, to be married. But I imagined that she had a family and maybe she had siblings who had, you know, they were able to get married and have children. And so she, in some ways, could, you know, vicariously have children through them. You know, she was possibly, she could have been an aunt. So in more ways than one, I was thinking less about her medical or sort of physiological ailment, but more about the community and social sort of illness or consequences, I guess, of that illness. And that probably felt, yeah, I think that was just a way into her story, because I think that in some ways, many of us, you know, have maybe experienced that sort of isolation and loneliness, and certainly queer people maybe would be able to identify with that a little bit more. And not just queer people, but, you know, immigrants, people with certain disabilities. I'm a pastor of a church, and I think often of the older folks that I visit who are either in assisted living facilities or maybe they're still living at home, but they're, especially during the pandemic, they were super, super lonely. And that I just had a conversation with one. I mean, she said it really messed her up, you know, it really messed her up these 2 years. And so I think that was what was so compelling to me about that story. And for Jesus to come with the healing was not necessarily about the blood issue. I mean, the blood issue, healing that blood issue, then in that context, allowed her to re-enter the community. But for her to be seen by him wholly and completely in that moment, I think, yeah, he just had queer ways of dealing with and interacting with people, but like somehow he knew exactly what people needed. And so, yeah, just the whole story is just really beautiful. You know, she doesn't really approach him directly. You know, she kind of, which is, I feel like something I would have done too. I would have just been like, okay, I'll just slide in there very quietly and just kind of touch a tiny bit. But even that tiny touch changed, you know, it stopped Jesus in his tracks and he turns around and who knows what he was doing and where he was going, but then all of a sudden everyone is oriented to that interaction in that moment. Which I think just to be seen and to be loved in that way is just, you know, that was the miracle to me in some ways.
It's those intersections, you know, mm-hmm. How do I intersect? I'm a Black woman. Mm-hmm. I've come from poverty and I still often have that poverty mindset. Mm-hmm. I have a chronic pain condition. So all of these things, you know, like the only two times I walked out of a church, one of them was because the evangelist, he was just, you know, if you have faith, you won't be sick. And he was so down. Wow. On people who were sick. And I was like, I can't do this with this man because I'm sick, you know, yeah. I'm sick a lot. Mm. And, you know, even as a Black person going to church in white spaces, yeah. there was still that disconnect when you don't see any people of color in leadership and you're kind of, you know, isolated in the back, not misunderstood. Like if the police shot and killed a Black person, an unarmed Black person, are they gonna talk about that in church? Mm-hmm. How it affects me, even if I'm like one of four Black people, is this going to be addressed? Yeah. So I think people with these, you know, difficult intersections, We need to touch Jesus, and we need Jesus to turn around and see us for exactly who we are. So thank you for that.
No, that's beautiful. And I thank you for, again, I mean, I think it's important to lift up. I mean, it's definitely the social, there's a social aspect to this, but there's definitely the physical, the material and the bodily aspect. I mean, she definitely had something that nobody could figure out. And it was within her body and it affected her body. And that's very real. And I think that probably a lot of people overlook that. And I can't remember. I feel like I maybe did not touch that as much as I could have or should have in the book. Just how important it is to recognize how these things impact our bodies, and like they can't be divorced from each other. What impacts our bodies impacts our social relationships as well. And to recognize, you know, the people around us, you know, there's that kind of cliche, like, I don't even know. I always butcher these things, but something to the effect of, you know, everybody's dealing with something, or everybody's fighting something or battling something. So, you know, to treat people with kindness and that sort of thing. And I really do think that if we were more aware of people's bodies and all the things that people's, I mean, yeah, we just continue to lift up and think like the white male able-bodied individual is like, you know, the be all end all. And that's just not real life. Yeah, I appreciate your story and your reminder of that what's happening in our bodies is super is essential to our social relationships.
As Christine and I have done this Lift Every Voice book club, we have chatted with people, some of which have chronic illnesses. And one of the things, and I think both of us learned, and Christine can verify, is to not hold ourselves against an ableist standard. And even now, you know, if I'm too sick to work one day, and I say to my best friend, oh my gosh, I can't do anything. I feel so bad and not productive. And then we kind of remind each other, because she's a diabetic, yeah, you sound an ableist right now. And so I really appreciate that you brought out, you know, how we are embodied, and we really can't divorce who we are spiritually, emotionally, from this body that we live in.
Yeah. Yeah. That's Sean Copeland once more again, within fleshing and fleshing freedom for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that, Claudia Love. I appreciate you sharing that. And yeah, we both, Claudia Love and I both deal with ongoing chronic pain and illness. Mm-hmm. So I think, but it's also something that has deepened our friendship and our connection to one another. And I also want to, we have time for maybe one more question, and I want to make sure that we touch on pleasure. So I think that it's a beautiful way also to speak of our embodiment, because I find there's such a fear. We live in this sort of very pleasure-oriented culture, and yet there's also this terrible fear of pleasure in church culture. So it's sort of, I feel like this, you know, very opposite sort of perspective. And you write about how, you know, Christians tend to demonize and vilify sex, but desiring God wholly and fully not only makes space for, but inspires our pleasure, which is really beautiful. And then loving and desiring God is a fuller picture of a God who also yearns for our happiness, our joy, and yes, even our pleasure. So I love this image, because I think, you know, it sort of tied into that sort of ableism too, I think, is this sense of the overwork, you know, the kind of Puritan culture that at least the United States comes from, where yeah, we don't ever slow ourselves down to allow ourselves just the pleasure and the joy of being present in the moment. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit more about this God who desires us to experience that pleasure of being human and how that happens through a body.
Yeah, for sure. I think something I didn't really, because it wasn't on my radar really at the time, is seeing how queerness is also meant to be, or understood as also very anti-capitalist. So I'm thinking about, you know, even the story you just told, Claudia, too, that the way that our structures are set up is to, you know, to diminish pleasure as much as possible and really narrow it so that pleasure is only associated with like reward, maybe, or sort of deserving, you know, if you've worked enough. You know, it's like the whole, like, God, again, those adages, like work first, play later. I don't know. You know what I'm really terrible with those phrases. I don't know why. I think it's the muddling of languages in my brain a little bit. But yeah, this sense of, you know, it's the puritanical Protestant, that Protestant ethic, you know, you have to be productive and churn out as much as you possibly can. And then, you know, when you've deserved it, you can have your quote unquote Sabbath and pleasure and joy and delight and whatnot. But that does feel very opposite from, you know, and I think it's, you know, maybe there's a little bit of that Genesis 1, the story of creation, and maybe that's it's sort of distortion and extension of a distorted sort of reading of that, you know, where God did all this work and then God rested. When God did that work out of God's joy and delight and pleasure, and rest was a part of that too. I think that, yeah, growing up in a house where, you know, it was just work, 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 I think we all kind of probably experienced that to some degree or another. And that pleasure was always either secondary, or, like, I think you mentioned, Christine, that it was sometimes even in some places demonized, especially if it's associated with sex. So definitely thinking about sex as very instrumental, you know, for, like, I just always understood it as, and even in health classes, you know, I think that my generation took like sex ed in fourth grade. I mean, I just remember learning the mechanics. I mean, that's how it was showed, you know, the mechanics of sex. And then we did like a week of carrying around an egg, pretending it was our baby, you know? So sex being framed in that way towards reproduction, it's like, that's not very pleasurable at all. I don't even know when. I mean, I feel like it's fairly recent history. I mean, maybe in the last 10 years or so that started to embrace. I mean, it was probably before that too, but it was still just like, you know, when my husband and I were trying to get pregnant, you know, it was still like, you know, you're having sex, but it was still like towards the aim of you're trying to get pregnant. We're trying to get pregnant. You know, we would try to throw in some stuff there. Gosh, this is maybe a lot of information, but you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I think it was it's very, very recent. And Nadia Bolz-Weber, I think, her latest book, Shameless, and other sort of resources that have come out, you know, in that sort of within that same sort of thinking, you know, that's really helpful to think about. You know, pleasure should be all of it. You know, we shouldn't feel ashamed of it. And I think that that's, you know, it's so hard now to disentangle that, or for a lot of folks, to disentangle, you know, expectations around work, you know, the whole imposition of shame, or interweaving shame with it, you know, whether desiring it or experiencing it. And I think ultimately what it does is it limits our experience of being human and God's creation. Beautiful. So just, I did a lot of rambling and I was trying to get to that point.
Yeah. And I think that's actually a beautiful place to bring our conversation to a close is, you know, pleasure as expanding our humanity and our experience of what it is to be human and what God desires for us. Yeah. Thank you so much, Mihi. Claudia Love, did you have any other final comments before we close?
Just one. Mm-hmm. Purity culture.
Yeah.
Did so much damage to people and our ability to receive and enjoy pleasure. Mm-hmm. And I see a lot of people right now trying to heal from the lessons that they got through purity culture.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Well, we're so grateful for your book to contribute to that conversation of healing. Outside the lines, how embracing queerness will transform your faith. It's been a real pleasure having this conversation with you, Mihi. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, and so great to finally connect with you too. And I'm so appreciative and so just in admiration of the work that you're doing in the world. Just very encouraged by it, and will continue to hold you all up in prayer and hope that you continue to impact the people around you and continue to spread that impact as much as possible.
Thank you.
Thank you.